Morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Richard Abbott on behalf of the appellants, Friends of H. Fletcher Brown Mansion and nearby residents, many of whom are in the courtroom here today. This is an appeal involving a challenge to a use variance granted by the City of Wilmington Zoning Board of Adjustment, which I'll refer to in abbreviated form as ZBA. The standard of review for errors of law is de novo. The standard of review for factual findings is substantial evidence, which has been defined by this court as more than a scintilla but less than a preponderance. We would respectfully request that the court reverse the Superior Court's affirmance of the use variance on three separate grounds. In summary, they are, number one, it violates the comprehensive plan in contravention of Section 702D of Title 22. Second, the ZBA was not properly constituted in terms of its membership, thereby lacking a majority for a valid approval per 22 Del C, Section 322A. Third, there was no specific monetary proof of sufficient weight regarding two of the four variance test factors. Those two factors are somewhat interrelated. One is reasonable rate of return. The other is economic unfeasibility. Your Honors dealt with a similar case involving a use variance just last year in the Rehoboth Art League case, and we've cited that for the standards. Argument one, the West Side Comprehensive Plan, which is the applicable plan under this matter, specifically designates the parcel in question for low-density residential uses. That's at page A-53 of the appendix. The use variance permits high-density residential apartment building use. So there's a conflict. And the reason it permits that, A-36 of the appendix, it's a table that reflects that R5 zoning categories are the applicable high-density apartment use that the use variance granted. Under 22 Del C, Section 702D, that comprehensive plan, quote, shall have the force of law and no development shall be permitted except as consistent with the plan, close quote. That provision has been interpreted by the Court of Chancery in two separate cases, O'Neill versus Town of Middletown, Brohan versus Town of Laurel. In each instance, the court concluded that because there was a specific designation, first in O'Neill in the map, the land use map, and second in Brohan in the text of the comprehensive plan, that that specific designation of the property and the fact that the zoning approval was inconsistent with it was grounds for reversal. The second argument, two of the three ZBA members were not legally valid members. Under the method that the City of Wilmington has chosen to compose their Board of Adjustment, the persons who serve are the mayor or his or her designee, second, the city solicitor, third, the city engineer. Now, if there is no city solicitor and or no city engineer, then there's an alternative means to place people in the positions for those two other slots on the ZBA. I also note there are two other methods by which the city could compose its Board of Adjustment. It chose not to do so. It chose this specific method. Under the circumstances, the first assistant city solicitor, rather than the city solicitor, served. Secondly, a member of the Public Works Department of the city served, rather than Lawrence Carson, who is the city engineer. So under those circumstances, there was a lack of majority, only one valid member, who was a designee of the mayor, as permitted specifically by the statute.
Now, with regard to this argument, let's assume that you're correct. And what are the implications for prior Board of Adjustment decisions that didn't have the correct composition?
Not a problem, because there's a 30-day statutory limitations period for filing an appeal. So unless this court ruled and a decision was made within that 30-day time frame, all other prior decisions would remain valid.
So, in effect, since we haven't really focused on this aspect of the statute before, if we agree with you that in a sentence that says mayor or his designee, that doesn't say city solicitor or his designee or her designee or city engineer or his or her designee, you have to have the city solicitor, the city engineer, and the mayor or a designee, it would simply operate prospectively.
Other than if there was just a decision issued and someone still had time within the 30-day time frame.
Right. Now, I understand that.
Yes, that is correct, Your Honor. The city is required.
Now,
I'm sorry.
Before we leave that, as you know, in their briefs, your opponents talk about some internal operation of the city based on a different document that says people can substitute. And it's my understanding from reading your brief that this specific statute controls the Board of Adjustment and whatever internal operations the city have to let people substitute for each other doesn't apply or override this specific statute.
Correct. To the extent that it's in the city code, obviously the statute would prevail since it is higher in authority. To the extent that it would be in the city charter, a general provision that permits someone to substitute as an acting director or administrator would be superseded by the specific statutory provision on the ZBA. Now, also of note is the fact that this court and lower courts have ruled for decades that because the zoning power is delegated by the General Assembly, that its implementation at the local level must be in strict conformance with the precise technical terms. That has included such things as invalidation based on the failure to approve rezonings by ordinance, the failure to give proper notice. All the technical requirements must be complied with. Strict conformance is the rule. The third point regarding specific monetary proof, primarily, we start out with this court's decision in Baker versus Connell that talks about monetary proof being required. That was then, at least in the trial court level, further expounded upon by Judge Quillen in the Hanley 1 case when he specifically held that specific monetary proof was necessary. In the follow-up case that was decided by Judge Carpenter, Hanley 2, I think Judge Quillen had left the bench by then, the specific monetary proof, by way of example, is testimony by a realtor regarding specific rental rates in the marketplace at that period of time in order to provide the appropriate weight to meet the substantial evidence test. In this case, all we had was hearsay testimony by the president of Ingleside who talked about studies that had been done at some time in the past. We don't know when. We don't know by whom. We don't know if they were done in a letter format, a formal report format. We don't know any of those details. No written documentation was submitted. And all he stated was things that sound unusual in that he gave a broad range of both rental rates, $8 to $22 per square foot, as well as renovation costs, $1.8 million to $3 million. I don't know how you jibe that with the specific monetary proof, but we would suggest that it doesn't meet the standard. If Mr. Cessna had submitted those reports in writing so that you could test them and you could weigh them, then that you could meet the more than scintilla of evidence standard, then he may have been able to satisfy that legal standard. But I would suggest that non-expert hearsay testimony by the president of the applicant is barely a scintilla and does not rise to the level of less than a preponderance of the evidence. So,
could we go back for a minute,
Your Honor,
to the issue about the composition of the board?
Yes.
Your opponents indicate that technically one of the members of the board has to be the chief engineer of the street and sewer department, and there is no such person or designation anymore. How does that square with your contention that the exact term of the title of the person is the person who has to serve?
Well, the statute uses the terms chief engineer and city engineer in different clauses. And, in fact, there is a city engineer, that's Mr. Carson, and he's with the Public Works Department. The term I would suggest in the statute is one that's provided generally because with 50-some municipalities in the state of Delaware, they call their departments different names. But I would submit, and I don't think the city has contested, that their public works department is the one that handles sewers and streets and so forth. In fact, Mr. Blankenship, who was the person serving, is the director of transportation, a streets component. So that would certainly also lend credence to the belief that the public works department is, in fact, that department that is described in the statute. So given that, the city engineer would be the person that would be required by statute to serve. I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Your Honors. John Tracy from Young Conaway, Stargett & Taylor here on behalf of the appellant Ingleside Homes. Sitting with me at council table is Martin Meltzer with the City of Wilmington Law Department. We have divided the responsibilities today. I'll be addressing the two land use aspects of this appeal. Mr. Meltzer will be addressing the appeal that you, Your Honors, were discussing with Mr. Abbott regarding the composition of the Board of Adjustment. The appellants challenged two aspects of the Superior Court and therefore the Board of Adjustment's ruling on the land use aspects of this matter. One, whether substantial evidence existed on the record to support the award of a use variance to Ingleside Homes, and as a corollary to that, whether the use variance that was granted violated the comprehensive development plans, because there are two that are applicable for the City of Wilmington.
How would you describe the difference in between this application for a use variance and the application for rezoning that was unsuccessful? Did they want to do something really different, or it's pretty much the same thing?
They are different, clearly, from a land use aspect. I will tell Your Honors that I was not involved in the rezoning aspect of this, so what I'm gleaning from this is coming from the record. But a rezoning, as I'm sure the Court is aware,
I know what you need for a rezoning. And what I'd like to know is, if it had been rezoned, are they going to do what they're doing now with this application for a use variance?
It's actually a more reduced project in scope than what was originally sought under the rezoning. Additionally, the rezoning would have allowed any use permitted by R5B, not just an apartment building, but for instance a hospital, a parking garage, any other use that's contained in any of the subsidiary residential zones within the city. When the rezoning was elected not to be pursued, that's when, if Your Honors have read or seen the transcript, that's when the working group was formed for folks to come up with different alternative uses as a way to preserve this rather large and historic structure. That's when the scope of the project was scaled down. The number of units, for instance, was reduced from 54 to 35, if memory serves correctly. It also allowed the existing facilities, which are already intertwined with the Ingleside apartments, which sit on the next parcel. They're physically connected both by sidewalks external to the property as well as by covered walkways. Air handlers and the like that serve the apartments are actually on the property of the Ingleside home. So I guess the direct answer to your question, it was a scaled-down request. Also, and this dovetails with Blake versus Sussex County, which was a conditional use case from 1997, in dealing with these comprehensive development plan issues. The court noted that a conditional use, which in some respects is similar to a use variance, that is, it's targeted to one particular use as opposed to any use that could be done under a change in zoning classification, noted that that was an appropriate way to try to handle these types of particularized requests. The issue that we run into, and it's the issue that I think has confronted the court and it's discussed in the O'Neill opinion that I think Mr. Abbott referenced, as well as Brohound and in a more recent opinion, Donnelly versus the City of Dover, comprehensive development plans are best guesses. They're looking into the future to try to predict what's going to happen in a particular area. In the case of the city, there are actually two comprehensive development plans. There's the citywide comprehensive development plan, which talks about general strategies that the city would like to employ, such as, for instance, protecting historic structures, finding additional housing opportunities for the elderly. But that comprehensive development plan begat several little comprehensive development plans that apply to the different communities in the city of Wilmington, neighborhood comprehensive plans. The West Side comprehensive plan was last updated for this court's purposes in 1978. It was actually updated again shortly after this Board of Adjustment hearing took place. That one suggested that low-density residential uses would be appropriate in this area and also suggests that they wanted to preserve, among other things, historic structures and historic treasures in the West Side area. In this particular instance, you had a structure that dated back to 1918, which was falling into disrepair and, as I mentioned previously, was connected with the existing Ingleside apartment.
Can I interrupt for a second? You said that the West Side Comprehensive Development Plan has been amended since this litigation started or since this process began. would it, under its current iteration, permit what you're doing?
I would argue that it would, and I would argue that because in the plan, it shows on the map for the current land uses, it shows this property as being high-density residential, the same as the apartments next door to it. Mr. Abbott notes in his reply brief that the zoning category hasn't changed, though, in the proposed land uses. It still shows R1 in there, but I think that those two are, in respect, mutually exclusive. That is, again, going to the argument I was making previously, a use variance does not change your underlying zoning classification, so that the underlying zoning classification can remain R1. What the use variance does is it allows you to engage in one specific targeted use, thus avoiding having to change the zoning classification and potentially opening up the property years from now or months from now to any use that would be permitted under the R5.
Well, what I'm trying to get at, and maybe I'm oversimplifying here, but admittedly, the new comprehensive development plan does not apply to this matter. However, are we arguing now with respect to the comprehensive development plan about something that, if it had to be done over again, would clearly be within or clearly be without the new comprehensive development plan? That's what I'm trying to...
I believe it would be within the new comprehensive development plan based on the way it's designating current land use, as showing this property is currently being used for high-density residential.
So, would you still need a use variance or not?
We would, because the underlying zoning classification remains the same. The underlying zoning classification is R1. The only way to do the use that was proposed here, the 35 low-income senior apartments, would be through the receipt of a use variance or a rezoning. The city had, in the materials that Mr. Abbott provided in his briefing, expressed reluctance to want to do a rezoning to the level that had been originally requested. That's why the use variance was chosen. And the use variance, I think, dovetails with the comprehensive development plan, because the issue, if the appellant's brief is to be taken at face value, I think almost but eliminates the ability to use a use variance anywhere in the state of Delaware. The use variance is a statutorily authorized land use tool that is applicable in all three counties as well as to municipalities through Article 22. And the statute, in particular, 22 Del Code 327A3, notes that variances can be granted without substantially impairing the intent and purpose of any zoning code, ordinance, regulation, or map. What that suggests is, and I think it's only logical, is that some impairment of that map is permissible, because you are necessarily, even if it's a dimensional variance, changing the setbacks for your front deck, you're doing something prescribed by the zoning code from an area standpoint. Use variance, it's the same thing. You're doing a use that the zoning code doesn't permit, but it's in recognition of the fact that the zoning code and the comprehensive development plan, particularly one that was last updated 30 years ago, can't foresee in the future and can't know what's going to happen at every specific parcel at every given time. So these tools, these variances, are available for folks to utilize if they find themselves in unique situations that can't be substantially addressed by the zoning code. In this particular instance, you had a huge structure that harkened back to the heydays of Wilmington, when such large structures were perhaps more common, that had not been used for a residence for decades and was falling into disrepair. It was also connected physically to a 208-unit, 15-story apartment tower. There needed to be a mechanism to try to find a way to allow a reasonable use of the property without harming the neighborhood around. And as the briefs point out, the neighborhood has a variety of different uses, from this high-rise apartment that I've referenced to a number of different schools. It's high-density, low-density, medium-density, institutional uses are all in this immediate area. So the question for the court to answer when awarding the variance was whether there was a substantial impairment into the intent and purpose of the zoning code. And if you take the argument that the comprehensive development plan must be strictly applied in every instance without any flexibility, which I think goes counter to what the courts have said in the past, you've essentially made it, I would argue, impossible to ever get a variance, because the code would have prescribed, the plan would have prescribed exactly what you could do, and therefore, under the appellant's reasoning, would prevent all other uses. In fact, I wonder, were someone to come in, as was suggested in the briefing and more particularly in front of the Board of Adjustment, to come in to try to put a school at this location or an office at this location. I mean, by its terms, those are not low-density residential uses, yet they're terms that are permitted by special exception from the Board of Adjustment in that zoning classification. Taking the argument at face value that only low-density residential would be permitted, it would seem that you foreclosed a number of alternative uses that the code is already anticipating. With the court's indulgence, I just wanted to briefly jump to the substantial evidence analysis. Mr. Abbott has, I think, conceded that we've satisfied two of the four standards, so what we're really fighting about is whether a sufficient economic proof was introduced in front of the Board of Adjustment to demonstrate the need for this. I liken it in some respects to the CCS Investors versus Brown case, which this court considered, I believe, a couple of years ago. Mr. Abbott has gone over the testimony that was presented. As this court is well aware, the standard is substantial evidence. This court's job is not to step into the shoes and evaluate the evidence on its own, but it's to step into the shoes of the court to look at how it evaluated to make sure that that evaluation was not an error. In this instance, there was evidence presented. There was evidence presented not only by Mr. Cessna, who was the president of Ingleside Homes. There was evidence presented by a member of the working group. There was also evidence presented by the local city councilman, who was also involved in the working group process, to detail the path that had been undertaken over the three previous years to try to reach some kind of resolution to this issue. It was clear from the testimony in front of the Board of Adjustment that folks did not want to see this structure removed. The plan that's presently is in front of the board and has been approved by the board in the Superior Court preserved, I would say, roughly 85% of that structure, I think 10,000 of approximately 12,000 square feet of the building, in order to rehabilitate it for purposes of being used. I think the evidence from the record was substantial for the board to award the variance. Superior Court concluded that there was substantial evidence as well, and I would ask this court to reach the same conclusion.
As I understand the argument about substantial evidence, it focuses on financial information, value. To simply say there was substantial evidence because there was evidence presented from four different sources doesn't answer that question. What's your answer to that question?
There's no bright line that's ever been drawn. Obviously, the Hanley case, there was particular evidence. I noticed that my red light is on. May I finish answering your question,
yes, please,
Your Honor? In the Hanley case, there was a certain type of evidence that was presented. The court in that case found that that evidence was substantial evidence. It did not set a bar requiring a particular type of evidence. There was testimony presented on the record by the president of Ingleside, which had commissioned the various studies that had been done, as well as the real estate appraisals that had been done, presenting what the findings were with regard to that at the invitation of the board. They were pro se in that matter, and I appreciate the fact that the chairman of the board asked that question to draw that response out from the president. No evidentiary case is perfect in front of a Board of Adjustment. I've done many of those presentations. There are always things I wish I would have done or added to it. In this instance, there was evidence presented on the record. I believe I heard Mr. Abbott say that it was more than a scintilla of evidence on this fact, which the standard is more than a scintilla and less than a preponderance. That bright line has never been drawn. It's obviously our feeling that we believe that we have produced more than a scintilla of evidence on the issue of financial hardship.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, opposing counsel, co-counsel. My name is Martin Meltzer. I'm assistant city solicitor of the City of Wilmington. I will be discussing the issue of the composition of the Wilmington Zoning Board of Adjustments hereafter, the ZBA. The basis of the appellate's argument is that 22 Delaware Code Section 322A must be strictly interpreted. There must be no deviation or delegation of authority except by the title of mayor. 22 Delaware Code 321N322 was created by the legislature to provide cities and incorporated towns in Delaware with the authority to appoint boards of adjustments. Section 321 also gives city and towns the authority to create their own rules and regulations. When the legislature created the Section 321 and Section 322, they had to consider the entire state of Delaware anywhere from the city of Wilmington, which has 79,000 people, to Delaware City with 1,400, to Dewey Beach with 300. Some have legal departments, some have public work departments, others have none, and some have things in between in which they have different titles. So therefore, the 322, which provides a composition of the zoning board, should be read like 321, broadly, liberally, and in harmony with the general purpose established for establishing zoning boards of adjustments consistent with the prevailing laws of Delaware.
All right. Well, let me ask you a question. Let's look at 322A. There are three people designated. Let's just focus on city solicitor and mayor. In one sentence, it says mayor or authorized agent of the mayor.
Yes.
After the word city solicitor, it does not say or authorized agent of the city solicitor.
Yes, Your Honor. And that that does not prohibit designees. In fact, the...
Okay, but you need to help this court, because we have three branches of government in the state, and the people elect the General Assembly. The General Assembly passes statutes. Mm-hmm. If a statute's unambiguous, we have to apply it literally. Tell us how we can read this sentence and permit the city solicitor to designate someone when it specifically says the mayor can do it, but not the city solicitor. What? Tell me some principle of statutory construction that will get us there.
Yes, and I do have it.
Great.
I just have to find it. The when you take a look at the statute in itself uses different titles. For instance, it uses mayor, that could have a designee, and then later on it says chief executive, that can appoint other people. Well, if you have a chief executive, if you use strict interpretation, you have a chief executive, but not the title mayor, does that mean that chief executive cannot appoint somebody? But if we go further on, the fact that 322 does not prohibit designees from sitting on the board, as the appellate would want us to consider, is very important in statutory interpretation. Where a statute is silent on the question of you must look for a reasonable result. Statute is silent on the question of delegation to a single executive head, such as a city solicitor. The courts almost universally hold.
How is the statute silent if it expressly speaks to the mayor or designee and for the city solicitor does not? How is that silence? There is a rule of statutory construction, is there not, that if the legislature knew it had a policy option of allowing a designee for the position of mayor, it had to know it had a policy option of a designee for the position of city solicitor. Not having exercised that option, how are we supposed to construe it?
Your Honor, I would say that unless, and I do have a case law that says, unless there is an indication where there is not permission to have a delegation, courts generally assume that the legislature expected there to be a delegation.
The statute did not provide for a designee for the mayor, your argument would have some logic. But since it does, but doesn't for the city solicitor, how is it possible to rationally construe those two options as the same?
Your Honor, and I'm saying, I know the argument is, what you're giving me is counterproductive to this, but I am stating that the statute is counterproductive to what I'm saying right now, but the statute in itself does not prohibit, it only says that the mayor can have a designee, but it doesn't prohibit.
Well, let's look at it differently. The statute says the city solicitor has to be on the Board of Adjustment.
Okay.
How can you put someone else on the Board of Adjustment?
Your Honor,
our question. The statute seems to say unambiguously and the city solicitor has to sit on the Board of Adjustment. Help us understand how the city can say, well, even though the statute says it has to be the city solicitor, we're sending someone else. How can they do that?
Your Honor, right through the prevailing laws of Delaware. The Wilmington City Charter, which was passed by the state legislature, expressly permits department heads in the cities to delegate their duties to others. The charter was passed in one charter in 1965 and the other in 1997. This was sanctioned by the state legislature. The section 322A was passed in 1953. Therefore, the newest statute prevails. And that statute under the Wilmington City Charter, section 3101, entitled department heads, state, each department shall have as its head an officer who, either personally or by deputy or by duly authorized agent, shall exercise the powers vested in and imposed upon that department. So therefore, through the city charter, the city may permit designees from that particular department. And in those departments listed in the charter is the city law department, also the city department of public works. Now, the statute particularly says that, as Her Honor brought out, that the statute says there should be a chief engineer of sewer and streets and sewers. It doesn't exist. So because that doesn't exist in the city, does that mean we cannot put somebody, an engineer, on that board? Later on it says city engineer, but it doesn't say the chief city engineer. It doesn't have to be, you know, the city engineer as Mr. Lawson. It just says city engineer. So it does change. It's not so much the title as it is the expertise. And through the charter, through the laws, the Wilmington does comply when it puts a designee down.
Well, let's go back to another issue of statutory construction, which is that a specific statute prevails over a general statute. If we look at 322, it says under A, we've been talking about you have three people on the board. And B says if you don't want to do what's in A, you can do it a completely different way. And in your brief, you say everybody's busy, so it makes sense to have someone other than the city solicitor on the board. That's the option you have under B if everybody's busy. Do it a completely different way. Under C, it says if you don't do it under B, we're back to A. And back to A says specifically the city solicitor.
Am I allowed to answer?
Sure, absolutely.
Oh, okay. Your Honor, I think by virtue of the home rule of the city, it is permitted through its charter to have designees through Section 322. As stated in the state of Dunn versus Mayor of Wilmington, it says that all the powers which under the Constitution of the state would be competent for the General Assembly to grant by specific enumerations and which are not denied by statute can go to the city, and it is not denied in this statute that they can, it's not specifically denied, they cannot have designees. Also, in the case of Boyd, which is cited in my brief, the court took a look at the composition of the board and took a look at the city's charter. In fact, it was very specific. It took a look at the 1965 charter, and it took a look at the 1997 charter, and it said as a result that they did establish a zoning board of adjustments and that those zoning board of adjustment is consistent with Section 322A. And therefore, I believe that the Boyd Court, its determination should be very persuasive in the composition of this board. And finally, if you take a look at the chapter,
let me interrupt you because you're over your time.
Yes, sir.
But you're allowed to answer my question. But let me ask you a different question. You were telling us about the years things were adopted, and in 322A, it talks about not having heretofore adopted a home rule charter. And as I understand it, when 322A was enacted, the city of Wilmington did not have a home rule charter.
Correct.
But later it adopted it. B specifically says if you have a home rule charter or you've adopted a home rule charter, then you can do everything in B. But the city of Wilmington did not elect to do that. So we're still back to A. Wouldn't that be correct?
That is correct.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
Your Honors, the only two issues I was going to address briefly are Mr. Tracy's comments about the comprehensive plan. I believe it's significant that he conceded that the 1978 plan is applicable, and we appreciate that concession. We would disagree, however, that the 2009 update, which was formally adopted on December 17th, the board decision was October, the written decision December 16th. So the chronology is clear. But in the 2009 update, there is no proposed land use plan. There's a map G that's at A-53 of our appendix that shows you a proposed land use plan. That specifically designates going forward what the uses should be for the properties within the West Side area. In contrast, with respect to the plan that was adopted in 2009, there is no such map. There are maps that basically tell us what the current zoning is and what the current land use is. So on the current land use map, which is map D that is attached to the Ingleside answering brief, and I don't see a page reference on it, but in any event, we would submit that does show current land use high density. That's because at the time that this plan was adopted on December 17, 2009, the use variance was approved. So that was a use, in effect, because the use variance had authorized a high density approval. So all that tells us is what's the current state of the law. That doesn't tell us what the vision or the objectives are for future use designations for the property. For whatever reason, in the update, the city simply didn't include such a document. And so as we've submitted in our brief, we would argue that the Map G proposed land use of the 1978 plan would continue to have effect. At best, however, in response to Your Honor's questions, I believe that issue is unclear. It is certainly not a certainty. There were some questions about why a use variance rather than a zoning. We don't want to take on the burden of having to prove what the motive was behind that, certainly. However, I guess the question that we have in our mind is, if it's simply a scaled-down version, then why not go back for a scaled-down version of the rezoning? It's done all the time when communities object and there's a compromise resolved and an alternative zoning proposal comes forward. I don't think that's relevant other than to the questions Your Honor had raised. Also, again, as I noted in the brief, in 1998, the General Assembly, for the very first time in Delaware, provided that comprehensive development plans for local jurisdictions would have binding effect. Prior to that time, they were more directory, shall we say. There's decisional law, and that's what Mr. Tracy relies on in the 1997 decision, that says that, generally speaking, you should try and follow comprehensive plans. But that is a judge-made rule. In 1998, the General Assembly intervened and said, we're going to clarify this and we're going to establish with certainty, henceforth, any types of land use decisions that are granted must be consistent with comprehensive plans.
How do you respond to the argument that under your approach to it, no use variance would ever be permitted because, by definition, it would be inconsistent with the comprehensive development plan?
Well, that presumes that the comprehensive development plans on their future or proposed land use maps only show what the current zoning is. I would submit to the court, we don't have it in the record, I apologize, but I would submit to the court you may be able to take judicial notice of the fact that when you adopt a future land use plan, many jurisdictions in this state specifically designate areas for potential upzoning, for potential higher density or higher intensity uses, and they apply various types of categories. In New Castle County, the current comprehensive plan calls it, I believe it's called the redevelopment area. And what that means is you may be able to go from residential to office or residential to commercial without a change in the comprehensive plan. So I would submit to Mr. Tracy that there are certainly numerous areas in Newcastle County that you could get a use variance for, and it would be consistent with the plan, even though the current zoning may be residential because of that characteristic I described. Mr. Tracy talks about the term substantial impairment. I gather he's drawing that from the 1997 decision. Again, I don't think that carries any weight because in 1998 the General Assembly changed the law in that area. So the issue is, are you strictly in conformance with the use designations contained in the plan? And absent strict conformance, then the approval must fail. The ZBA composition issue that Mr. Meltzer addressed, I think from what I could gather, the only argument really is that the charter permits department heads to delegate certain responsibilities. At best, that's general, as Justice Holland pointed out in his questions, and I think more appropriately, it really doesn't apply at all. And the reason for that is it's referring to delegation of regular responsibilities, not extraordinary responsibilities like those that have been expressly defined in statute by the General Assembly. Also, the city engineer is not the head of the Department of Public Works, or at least there's nothing in the record to that effect, and it doesn't appear based on Mr. Carson's correspondence that's in the record that he heads that department. He certainly doesn't have the title director of Public Works. The city lastly relies on the Boyd case, and that's distinguishable. President Judge Stiftel held that the provision in Section 322D that prohibits employees of the local jurisdiction from serving on a board of adjustment that's supposed to be composed of 3 to 5 members does not apply to A. Because in A, it specifically states that city employees, or in some instances you have contract attorneys or contract engineers, but in many instances as the city of Wilmington, you have a mayor. That's a city employee. You have a city solicitor. That's a city employee. And you have a city engineer, city employee. So I think it's just logical that President Judge Stiftel said you're relying on a provision in subsection D. That's a different composition of the board. And in that instance, you can have city employees. But in this instance, the General Assembly has provided that they shall be city employees. So Boyd does not stand for the proposition that, or does not rebut the proposition that we're asking the court to adopt in this case. So for those reasons, unless the court has any further questions, I'll rest and would respectfully request that the court reverse the decision of the Superior Court and invalidate the use variance.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.